Welcome to the November and December episode of the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation's RehabCast. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Vox. I hope you're having a fantastic holiday season. Now, in this jam-packed edition, we've got three interviews, kicking off first with Ben Harder. Ben is the Chief of Health Analysis at U.S. News & World Report. I sat down with him in the moments before his luncheon address and panel discussion at ACRM 2019 in Chicago. Ben is a current center of attention in the rehab world, as his magazine's prominent consumer rankings have in their sights a plan to incorporate metrics into their rankings of rehab hospitals. You're about to learn much more. Also joining us from the World Health Organization is Dr. Alarcos Cieza, who from her role at WHO is working to advance the organization's recently announced mission to significantly raise the prominence of rehabilitation in global health systems by 2030. It's a big job, and we get into the details with her shortly. And wrapping up this edition, we'll be talking with Dr. Karen Kepner of Case Western Reserve University, who in the December issue describes the rather low utilization of rehab services post-stroke in the Medicare population and her efforts to suss out trends that could explain disparities in the use of rehab services. All right, joining us on the RehabCast today is Ben Harder. Ben is Managing Editor and Chief of Health Analysis at U.S. News & World Report, in charge of its incredibly influential and important hospital rankings. Thanks for joining us today on the RehabCast.
My pleasure.
So I understand some big news is in store, and we're going to go ahead and spill the beans because this podcast is not going to air until after the big news has been announced at today's luncheon at ACRM. But you're going to talk in detail about what you've already presaged, which is that the field of rehabilitation medicine, as ranked by U.S. News & World Report, is moving from reputation only to starting to finally incorporate some metrics like most of the other fields that you rank. Let's go ahead and start out with what are these new metrics?
So before I talk about the metrics specifically, I would like to say that when we evaluate hospitals, we do so with a research question in mind. And so every methodology that we develop to evaluate hospitals starts with what question are we trying to answer and for whom. Mm-hmm. And so with the rankings that we published in rehabilitation, the focus has always been not on any rehab patient, but on those who need the most complex and challenging care. Some might call it catastrophic rehabilitation. So that has been the research question that's animated our rehab rankings from the beginning. And we have gotten to the point where we believe that there are some measures beyond the expert opinions of physiatrists, which is what we use right now, that can shed light on that research question. And so we're specifically looking at curating some of the measures that are available on IRF Compare. Mm-hmm. And certain structural characteristics that are of the hospital that are available to us through other data sources, particularly the American Hospital Association annual survey database. And so those two, in combination with our ongoing annual survey of physiatrists and board-certified PM&R specialists, is what we will use for the rankings in 2020. And we expect, as time goes by, that we'll be able to identify additional measures and refine how we use the data available to us to answer that research question for those patients and families who need catastrophic rehabilitation.
Now, that reputational survey part, rehab isn't the only field that's just had a reputational survey for some time due to the lack of available metrics or ones that folks can agree on. What is the specific question that the rehab doctors are asked?
So they're asked, do people use the term reputation for it frequently? We did ourselves for many years. I now prefer expert opinion. And the reason for that is that it is essentially what I would consider the wisdom of the specialty. It's not the wisdom of a generic crowd. It's specifically the doctors who are trained in the field that we ask. The question is essentially a hypothetical referral question. We ask doctors to recommend up to five hospitals or name up to five hospitals where that they see as providing the best care for the most complex and challenging patients in their specialty. So it's specialty specific, and it's explicitly focused on the complex, challenging cases. And so you might think of it as essentially what are the best referral centers for the highest level of care in the specialty.
I see. Okay. Now, getting to the sources of data that are going to be used this time around, so you're referencing the CMS IRF Compare tool, And I suppose that tool has parallels to things that are used, for example, in the skilled care facilities and so forth that you've ranked as well. Now, I'm in a unique role here as both a roving reporter for ACRM, host of this ACRM podcast. I do happen to be from a particular type of rehab hospital that, interestingly enough, is not ranked in that system.
Yes.
Because we're not an IRF. We're an LTAC, like a few are. So I do want to ask you about that. That said, most of our listeners are in the IRF, and I do want to reflect that as well. Let's talk about first the pros of the CMS IRF Compare tool, and what do you expect to find most useful out of that?
Sure. So in some sense, it's actually one converges around one question there, because I think, you know, since you provide care at an LTAC, and there are some other LTACs that provide very specialized higher level rehabilitation care, there are no data on IRF Compare related to the care provided at those facilities. But even for those hospitals that are designated as IRFs, the patient population that is the focus of our research question isn't necessarily the patient population that's in the denominators of the measures that are available on IRF Compare. And so that is candidly a limitation of the data available, and it's one of the reasons that for so many years we have relied exclusively on the expert opinion of physiatrists in producing our rankings. That said, I think we have gained enough experience with the measures, not only in our evolving understanding of the data that are available on IRF Compare, but also how measures such as in other areas of care relate to expert opinion and to indicators of quality that may be more comprehensive or more specific to the patient population, to gain a lot of confidence in certain types of measures. And in particular, and I think your audience will probably have a diverse opinions about this, but I would assert that claims-based outcomes measures can be very powerful indicators of quality. Mm-hmm. They are proxies. They're not perfect measures because claims have their own limitations, but they are very often powerfully correlated with other measures of quality, including things like volume and expert opinion and outcomes as measured in registries and so on and so forth. So we think that a number of the outcomes that are available on IRF Compare are important proxies for even where the patient population, that sort of catastrophic rehabilitation patient, may not be the entirety of the denominator or may in fact be largely missing from the denominator, we think that that still provides important signal for us in the rankings.
Right. I suppose part of the conversation you're going to have today with the panelists and so forth with regards to concerns about IRF Compare is the divergence in the rehabilitation field about kind of elder rehab versus this younger catastrophic,
right,
which you're certainly referencing as well, and the numbers reflective of that as well. I don't know how many rehab doctors have my experience per se, in particular with some of the more TBI intensive programs, but when I think about this personally, I'll just state it has been quite a while since I can recall my last CMS TBI patient, because the average age of that population is young, you know, in the 40s and so forth. If we're looking at your person who is on Medicare and has had a brain, it's typically going to be an elder fall with perhaps a subdural hematoma or something like that, usually more straightforward than car accident, polytrauma with multiple organ damage and that type of thing. What are your thoughts about how you mitigate for that when the N might be quite small for given facilities out there that are quite focused on that younger population?
Right. So I think the sample size problem is a big challenge. What is not a challenge, because the IRF Compare measures are limited to Medicare fee-for-service population, is I think we need to remember that we don't need to risk adjust for the entire gamut of the patient population that different facilities encounter, because the patients who are, you know, the young car accident victim who may be a disproportionate number of the patients treated at a facility like yours aren't going to be part of that measure. And so we don't necessarily need to account for all of the clinical nuance that affects that population that doesn't affect the Medicare fee-for-service population. That said, if your facility, if many facilities that specialize in the catastrophic patient don't have very few patients in the sort of the CMS denominator, those measures are not necessarily going to be as reliable statistically. They just have smaller sample size, and they may not be as discriminating as they could be. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, I think the what you'll see in the U.S. News rankings in 2020 is a moderate amount of emphasis and weight put on those measures because of the limited discrimination they offer and because in some cases the sample size is quite small.
I think another concern you're likely to hear is that what defines an ERF according to CMS criteria is a set of a list of certain diagnoses that has to meet the 60% threshold, about 13 different diagnoses. And within that, there's quite a lot of variance. For example, admitting a person with paraplegia, paralysis of both legs, counts as a spinal cord injury for that, but also a person with quadriplegia, all four extremities, on a ventilator, counts the same for the criteria, for example. And when you look at the different facilities out there, those that are more intensive and say spinal cord injury, to use this example, for example, are admitting more of the patients with tetraplegia than paraplegia and that type of thing. How are you rating for severity of illness and waiting for that in these new rankings?
That's a great question. So we have limited visibility into the severity of illness within the diagnostic categories that you describe, and the ratio of patients from one diagnostic category to another provides some information, but is not definitely the be all and end all. We do plan to use as part of our quality measurement paradigm, the volume of patients that each ERF has seen in certain higher complexity diagnostic categories. And what we're envisioning right now is using traumatic brain injury, traumatic spinal cord injury, and stroke. And we chose stroke even though there can be a wide range of severity within that because both data on utilization and the average in that category suggests that it is more similar to the comprehensive, sort of the high acuity care, and also because, frankly, that is the population that we're most likely to capture in the Medicare fee-for-service population. So we know that we're under sampling facilities on traumatic spinal cord injury and brain injury in using Medicare data.
Another question about ERF compare data before we move on to the AHA hospital survey and what's in that. There are some kind of competing private sources of data that aren't as specific with regards to payer, whether CMS or others like eRehab and UDS. What are your thoughts about those sources of data and their accessibility to U.S. News for these rankings?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because those are very valuable potential sources of data. Right now, they're not available to us. And what we have done in other areas of care, particularly cardiovascular care, where we evaluate hospitals, and we've recently announced as well in neurology and neurosurgery because of newly available registry data, is that we have taken either used the data that's being published by the registry or used the public reporting status of individual facilities as quality indicators. And so, for example, hospitals that publicly report from a registry of coronary artery bypass are hospitals that do better across the board on average in all of the quality measures that we look at. And so we're able to use both the data that come off that registry and are in the public domain, thanks to the public reporting, and we're able to use whether the hospital has chosen to be transparent about that or not as a quality indicator in and of itself. And so I would hope that as the rehab community moves forward with the registries that they maintain now, that there may be some conversation around public reporting. It can be voluntary, but that could provide an additional source of much richer information for publishers like U.S. News.
I see. I'm going to put my reporter hat back on and ask you one follow-up question then, because that does pique my interest a little bit. U.S. News certainly does have the capacity to reach out to those organizations. Were you rebuffed by eRehab and UDS? And because that, I think, is of interest to the folks who are listening to this podcast, who are in the industry and are hopeful that those data sources can be used for quality improvement.
Mm-hmm. We have conversations ahead of us with them, not rebuffed at all. But I think that we've seen it takes a long time for registries to get to the point where their members, their participants, the specialty itself is ready for public reporting. And I think that we've seen that full life cycle with some of the registries. Certainly cardiovascular has been the arena where there's been the most and the, I think the earliest beginning of that work. And even there, the registries that are public reporting some measures and not others. And so I know that that is a conversation that has to happen within PM&R. I think if we can encourage it and perhaps accelerate it, that would be hopefully a virtuous role for U.S. News to serve. Mm-hmm. But we know that that has to come from the specialty itself.
Yeah. Now, you put out a call on your blog, I believe back in the spring, that everybody ought to fill out that HA hospital survey, since you're going to be using it this time around. Tell us, you know, what you're finding of great interest in that survey.
So there are a number of structural measures that we're interested in. Again, remembering that we are looking at the highest complexity patients. There are several different variables that we intend to get from the AHA survey. One is CARF accreditation. We know that there are a number of process measures and staffing measures that we can't measure directly, but CARF accreditation is a signal that many of those things are in place structurally and procedurally. We think that's an important factor. We, as we do in our rankings of hospitals in general medical and surgical care, we are planning to have an index of patient services that come from various AHA variables, and we're still working on the composition of that index. That may not be a rich discriminator among the hospitals that are already ranked by U.S. News, but we think it is an important additional signal in terms of how the services that are provided. And similarly, another set of variables that we would build into a clinical technologies index. And again, these are things that would be valuable, particularly for that higher complexity patient population. The last thing, as I mentioned, is volume. And so those that's not coming from the AHA survey, but those four things together represent what we would consider our structural domain of measures. So we intend to get select outcomes from IRF Compare. There are a few process measures that we intend to pull from IRF Compare, particularly vaccination rates, which we've found to be empirically very well correlated with outcomes and other quality measures. And then these four structural aspects of structural care, three of which come from AHA, and one is the volume indicators from IRF Compare.
I know every field of medicine is interested in their field being ranked on what they consider the most relevant metrics, and sometimes those are available and sometimes they aren't. For rehab, you know, some of the things I gather that are in the IRF Compare survey do include things like, transfer back to acute hospitals, staying out of the hospital after discharge and so forth, and those I think everyone would agree are certainly good proxy measures of quality. How about the core of the specialty itself, which is functional change, you know, taking somebody who can barely do anything to doing quite a lot by discharge?
That is an incredibly challenging thing to measure in a comparable manner from facility to facility. And it's not that's not exclusive to rehabilitation medicine. We would love to measure patient-reported outcomes and functional outcomes in all kinds of acute care. And the measures are not mature in most cases. There are ways that we can infer them in some cases, but I think that many of the measures that attempt to capture that information and can be very useful for quality improvement within a facility are not necessarily standardized sufficiently from one facility to the next, such that we can use them for benchmarking and comparing facilities to each other. And so some of the measures that we will not use from IRF Compare, for example, would have ones where we have concerns about the standardization and comparability across domains. And I think that functional outcomes and functional improvement are going to be a very challenging arena for the specialty to produce data that's really comparable. So it's a construct it's enormously important to the specialty, to patients, and to U.S. News. We're not going to jump the gun in terms of incorporating data that are ostensibly addressing that into our rankings if we don't have confidence and if the experts we consult with don't have confidence that those are meaningful measures.
I see. And we're about to wrap up here, but one more follow-up question for you about this distinction between Medicare data and other payers. Is this an issue that you've heard before from other fields of medicine, and how has it been dealt with there? You know, for example, was there a point in time when, you know, you're looking at just CMS data for cardiology and then move beyond that to other sources and that type of thing?
Yeah, it is something that we talk about in every specialty. I think it's more challenging in some ways in catastrophic rehabilitation than in others because of the demographics of the population. Obviously, in pediatrics, it's also a challenge, whether pediatric rehabilitation or other areas of pediatric care. The solution that U.S. News has used for pediatrics, as you may know, is that we survey hospitals directly, and we've mm-hmm. built a comprehensive inventory of measures with working groups and clinical input. The thing is, that's an incredibly burdensome survey for hospitals to participate in, and the only reason we can do it in pediatrics is that there's a very small number of hospitals that really specialize in pediatric care. I don't think that's something we can scale to rehabilitation at this time, and there too. To getting standardized data from hospitals is always a challenge that we think a lot about. So we don't envision directly surveying hospitals, but I think that there are, as you said, the e-rehabs, the UDSs, these registries present an opportunity for us to gain visibility into a broader population, and I hope that there will come a day when we can use that information, even understanding volumes of higher complexity. Diagnostic categories would be enormously helpful to get from those sorts of data sources.
Okay, excellent. Well, Ben, you've got the rehab world on the edge of their seats, and obviously are about to discuss this in more detail with the conference here and with panelists also, as well as at the U.S. News Healthcare of Today conference in a week. You're a busy man, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So joining us now on the Rehab Cast is Dr. Alarco Cieza. Dr. Cieza is the author of a couple of papers in the November 2019 issue of the Archives of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation. She is the author of a special communication paper entitled Rehabilitation, the Health Strategy of the 21st Century, Really? ? As well as with some of her colleagues at WHO on another special communication towards strengthening rehabilitation and health systems, methods used to develop a WHO package of rehabilitation interventions. Dr. Cieza is from WHO there at the World Health Organization. She is the coordinator of the blindness and deafness prevention, as well as disability and rehabilitation efforts and programs. Immediately prior to that, she was chair and professor of medical psychology at the Faculty of Social and Human Sciences at the University of Southampton in the UK. Dr. Cieza, thanks for joining us today on the Rehabcast.
I'm very happy to join you, and thank you for the invitation.
So these special communications in the journal are really a call to the rehab field in general. The latter paper that I mentioned is outlining an effort that the WHO is going to provide to identify certain key rehab interventions that all countries need to be aware of and hopefully make efforts towards. I suppose let's talk about the first paper first, though, which is the health strategy of the 21st century. Can we make rehab really a focus? And in this paper, you talk about the fact that WHO has made rehab a priority with a goal towards Rehabilitation 2030, a call for action that was launched in 2017. So we need to chat about that as well. But let's talk about the impetus of your paper and kind of what you're hoping to achieve here.
So what I wanted to achieve with this paper is to mobilize the rehabilitation community to unify it behind a single agenda, and actually the single agenda of strengthening health systems to provide rehabilitation services. One of the things that we need to be aware of, that, and sometimes I say this very provocative, that the need for rehabilitation is huge in countries. Mm-hmm. However, the provision of rehabilitation services is almost what we could say nowhere, and especially mm-hmm. in low-income settings. And the call to the rehabilitation community is, okay, we can maintain this status quo, or we can do something about it. And I address, especially in this paper, two issues that I think are fundamental if we want really to change this status quo. And the precondition for that, let me say, because I address two points of the paper, but the overarching point is actually rehabilitation is not a political priority. And what we need to do is to work together to make of rehabilitation a political priority, especially in health and in health systems. And one of the things that we need to work together towards too is really having a common understanding of what we are talking about when we talk about rehabilitation, because we portray it always in very different ways, depending on the stakeholders, but also depending on the context. And secondly is the stakeholders' cohesion. So it's everyone is looking, because of course the strength of rehabilitation is that we have many different stakeholders from the perspective of professional organizations. For example, we have the rehabilitation doctors, we have the speech and language therapies, we have the occupational therapies, the physical therapies, the psychologists, and so on. But everyone is advocating for their own field in different directions, exactly the same like the users. And then what we could expect of policymakers when deciding the priorities of the agendas, if everyone advocates for their own specific sector without having a common narrative, then the agenda of rehabilitation as a whole is what suffers at the end. So we really need to make an effort to come up with a common understanding and a common identity of rehabilitation, especially from the perspective of health professionals.
And it seems like the World Health Organization's rubrics for understanding disease and classifications and so forth is potentially quite helpful to that project. You point out that rehab is really kind of one of the top three that the whole medical system should be concerned with, as in right up there, there is morbidity, as in developing new diseases and so forth, and we want to prevent that. Mortality, the whole project of modern medicine hopes to prevent and delay death to some extent as much as possible. And then there's also function, so morbidity, mortality, function. And if we communicate to people and really emphasize that rehab is function and about preserving and developing function, then that will go a long way to keeping us, the field and, for providers as well as the people that we serve, right at the top of the mission statement of modern medicine.
Exactly. So it is, I always say, and we communicate. So for WHO, from a WHO perspective, is mortality, as you have said, morbidity and functioning. And only that, also in the health sector, we tend to forget functioning and function. And I think we can use now the term functioning and functioning as equivalents. So we usually use the term functioning, but it is understood in many different contexts as function, which is it is okay. And however, the rehabilitation community is not advocating for that what we target with our interventions, that is optimizing functioning. And if the rehabilitation does not do that, who else can do it? So it's also this call to really all stakeholders of rehabilitation. Yes, go or put yourself behind functioning and really portraying it at that what we achieve for rehabilitation, advocate for it as the third health indicators. Because actually I would say we don't have any other choice. We don't have any other choice for the sake of rehabilitation, I have to say, to change this status quo that I was talking at the beginning, but also taking into consideration the population and health trends around the world. We know that infectious diseases are going down, that is still there will be many people over the years to come living with the consequences of injuries and needing rehabilitation, and also that the number of people with what we call non-communicable diseases will be steadily increasing. And we are talking then about people with musculoskeletal conditions, with internal conditions like diabetes, like asthma, like also mental health disorders. So it's where it is not anymore about curing, but it is really about de-optimizing functioning, where rehabilitation is the main health strategy for that.
We probably need to, but I think people in the field understand this, but I think outside the field and communicating again to policymakers in the world generally, that precisely as modern medicine has become more successful at saving lives and preventing disease and managing disease and so forth, now rehabilitation function is, as a result, as a direct link, becoming more important to kind of the next phase of the whole medical project. You know, we have more people surviving for longer, mm-hmm. and this is happening now, just as it has, fortunately, in the developed world for some time, but now it's happening in the rest of the world, the developing world, and we are successfully saving lives, and this means that the next phase of the medical system needs to be about the quality of those lives.
Yeah, so that is the reason why I think we need to perceive it with this urgency. So it was also a call in this paper, for it is really an urgency there, to move forward. And again, if not the rehabilitation stakeholders, whose sons can do that? So it's really, we need to move forward in that direction.
Now, you discuss that there was a meeting back in July, the 2030 global meeting. Can you tell us about that meeting and how it went,
yeah,
and what was achieved,
yeah,
there?
Actually, it was a meeting that it was a success, actually, perceived from two different perspectives. I think from the perspective of WHO, and again, for WHO showing to all stakeholders of rehabilitation that for WHO, rehabilitation is a priority and it's in the agenda. It was a meeting where you have colleagues, so directors, assistant director generals, and so on, from across the organization, also taking part of this meeting, portraying that. But also from the perspective of the demand from member states, from countries, was overwhelming. So we have delegates from more than 70 countries, from ministries of health, that came to this meeting also because of the interest for rehabilitation, because at country level, ministries of health are also perceiving this increasing need for rehabilitation services. And of course, it was also an opportunity for the rehabilitation community and stakeholders of rehabilitation at international level to participate in this meeting.
Is the Global Rehabilitation Alliance, is that part of WHO, or is that a separate organization?
At this point, it's a separate organization. So it's still, it is at the initial steps, baby steps of moving forward, and still it's to see how this alliance will move forward. I have communicated also very often that it should be a strong collaboration also with WHO. But I think at this point it's still at the baby steps and need still to move forward. And WHO is positive with this development, and we will see how things will move forward.
So it sounds like it was quite an achievement to gather together so many different health ministers from so many countries around this particular issue of rehab and function back this summer. With that kind of opportunity, is there any type of statement that was perhaps produced from that, or something that people were agreeing to do and so forth?
So it was a big commitment to move the agenda forward, rehabilitation, and also implement one document that was launched during this meeting that is a guide for action. It's a guide for action containing technical tools that can be used to support countries, and WHO is already using, and some of our stakeholders are already using, supporting countries and ministries of health to carry out an assessment of the capacity of the country to provide rehabilitation services, also how good and what is the performance of the existing services, developing a strategic plan and implementation and monitoring framework. So it was a strong commitment from countries, but also from stakeholders to the implementation of this guide for action. There were another two important messages in this meeting. The first one was around functioning. So functioning being the third health indicator, and emphasizing this point that was already mentioned in the paper. So we need to be unified as a field behind this concept and really use it as discussion point with policymakers and everyone being behind it. And the another point that was emphasized is we need also to bring rehabilitation into primary health care. Also because, and there were also colleagues from the Institute of Health Metrics in Seattle, the institute putting forward all the global estimates of the burden of disease with us. And they also presented the estimates of the number of people who could benefit of rehabilitation at some point of their lives. And the data was presented at the level of billions. So the message was also, you know, the need is so huge, and also based on the fact that many of those conditions for which rehabilitation can be beneficial can be treated at the primary health level, we need also to think of rehabilitation more and more and at the primary health level and integrating rehabilitation services at primary health level, because otherwise we will not be able to address the huge need. And we tend to think very often of rehabilitation exclusively provided at secondary level and tertiary level in a specialized setting, but I think it was very important, the message that we need to think more and more of rehabilitation at primary health level to be successful in the future, and success assess in terms of addressing the still huge unmet need.
And part of kind of this overall conceptualization and kind of raising the profile and importance in health systems of the rehabilitation project, I think you identify a couple of key issues. One of which is that the different professional organizations and variety of professions involved perhaps aren't cohesive enough. And the other is that patients, the people may not be fully on board enough, perceiving perhaps that they're being labeled and boxed as disabled and so forth by the rehab system, rather than it again being about this kind of quality of life improvement project that everyone can benefit from. So what are your ideas about how to overcome those two barriers?
One of the things that actually does not happen in rehabilitation that has worked very effectively in other fields is the advocacy around users. So we don't have in rehabilitation really users and users communities advocating for rehabilitation services. So it is also a responsibility to really from, of course, WHO can play a role, but I think professional organizations and other stakeholders can also play different roles on really mobilize, and also the professional organization, but also condition specific organizations. When we talk also of international organizations around stroke or around neurological condition, musculoskeletal condition, also make an effort to really mobilize the voice of users for advocating for rehabilitation. That really does not happen. And one have to say the demand needs to come from very strongly from the user's perspective. And if this advocacy works well, of course, also policymakers need to respond to the requests of civil society and to the requests of civil society coming from users. So I think all stakeholders of rehabilitation in terms of professional organizations and international NGOs and also local and national NGOs have a responsibility to not only think of the provision of services and not only think of education of their own profession, but also of mobilizing these user groups.
Now, if folks listening to this podcast want to kind of get involved in kind of the Rehabilitation 2030 idea, or perhaps learn about the next meeting that you're going to have related to this, what are the steps that individual professionals can take?
Yeah, we have a webpage on Rehabilitation 2030 where we also have the all the information related to the meeting that was in 2017, also all the information with the report and even the link to the WebEx recording of all the session. Everyone can get the information in there. Simply searching in the web with Rehabilitation 2030 World Health Organization, you immediately come into the page. And then we have also a contact, so send an email, then we will be able to then include in our database and provide this information and then invite and provide additional information to everyone who requests it.
And finally, let's just chat for a minute about the effort to create a WHO package of rehab interventions and how you guys are going about that and where you are in the process.
So what I would say, anyone who has interest to know the details about this work can read the paper. There is already there quite a lot of intervention. I think in terms of the broader perspective, if it is one of the first requests that we get, especially from countries where services, rehabilitation services are almost not available, is the request of, okay, if I need to start providing rehabilitation services, what are the interventions that need to be provided? What are you talking about? So it is really the package contained the information of what are the interventions that need to be provided from a rehabilitation perspective when people have certain limitations in functioning and have certain health conditions. It is also the way and the strategy that WHO has to introduce rehabilitation into universal health coverage. Because universal health coverage means that anyone who needs certain services receive the services that are needed, including rehabilitation services, according to the need without financial hardship. And one of the first steps in order to move forward towards universal health coverage is to be able to provide the information. What is the budget that you need to spend in order to be able to provide those services? Or what is the budget that needs to be covered by insurance schemes? So if we can have this package of interventions will provide also the basis to calculate what is the infrastructure that is needed to provide the interventions, what are the consumables, what are the competencies of health professionals that are needed to provide those interventions, and then what are the professions behind, so that also a budget can be created, and then governments and ministries of health can look for mechanisms to cover the cost of the provision of the services. So it's really the entry point for the thinking of universal health coverage.
Now, I think one of the more challenging aspects when it comes to budgeting your national health service and everything, you know, for small as well as large economies, when it comes to rehab interventions in particular, and something the field needs to be very frank about, is that we are qualitatively different as to when the stopping point is and what the value is of a given intervention. There's not so much obviously, there are bleeding edge advances in every field of medicine with regards to particular medications and so forth and surgical procedures and that type of thing. But there is something qualitatively different about some aspects of rehab in terms of the therapy sessions, the equipment involved and so forth, and how long you provide rehab services for each intervention based on what gains you appear to be seeing. Mm-hmm. And I think where the rubber hits the road probably for a lot of these health ministers may be, you know, what is the most value that we can get out of each of this yeah. package of rehab interventions and so forth. So you're going to be trying to bite into that big problem.
Yeah, but we also have to be aware that such a package of interventions, and that is also some of the work that WHO is now initiating, is the entry point to making an investment case for rehabilitation. And we are already working very closely with our Department of Health System and Financing in order to make this investment case. Okay, what if governments and if ministries of health do a certain investment of a certain amount of dollars? So what is the return that is expected? And we are really exploring different approaches for that. There is not enough done in rehabilitation in this field, but we are moving forward also to this direction because, indeed, as you rightly say, it is one of the first questions that also come in the discussions with ministries of health. What do I get out of investing in rehabilitation? And investment cases is something that that we are moving forward to, and this package of rehabilitation interventions is also a fundamental step and a foundation for that.
It seems that that you know the treatment and improvement of function, of course, that is key to the rehab model and everything as well. But there is a flip side of function for every single treatment throughout the rest of medicine as well. So it's something that all health systems have to be thinking about. You know, what is the life of this individual going to look like, you know, if we provide X, Y, or Z procedure or medication or so forth. And that's where things get very sticky very quick in terms of, you know, who's going to pay for what and what is that worth.
Yeah. So, and never say that that the road is easy, but that can never be the reason to not to move forward in disentangling and really creating the evidence and putting forward the evidence that will enable all of this. But you are exactly right. So it will be the discussions and when you go into at the country level with the specific discussions is where things get concrete and things get also very often complicated, but the more we have the information available and disentangle and mention what are the kind of services and interventions what we are talking about when we talk about rehabilitation, the better can these discussions be moved forward.
Well, I think this is an important project that the WHO obviously is putting forward, and hopefully via this little podcast interview, more of the ACRM and journal readers are aware of the project and perhaps can get involved themselves. I do think that, although obviously American is right there in the name, but at any rate, it is an international organization, the ACRM as an interdisciplinary type of rehabilitation organization very much matches kind of the at least one of the key goals of what the WHO is talking about in terms of bringing together the disparate professions all related to rehabilitation under one project. And it's an organization where folks from different fields do seem to play quite nicely together to achieve national health aims in the U.S. and elsewhere. And we can certainly use more of that.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. Indeed.
Well, Dr. Cieza, thanks for your time today, and I appreciate your joining us.
Thank you very much. I was very happy to join you.
Joining us now on the Rehab Cast is Dr. Karen Kepner. Dr. Kepner and her colleagues are the authors of Utilization of Rehabilitation Services in Stroke, a study utilizing the Health and Retirement Study with linked Medicare claims data. This is in the December issue of the Archives. Dr. Kepner is assistant professor in the Occupational Therapy Program at the School of Health Sciences at Cleveland State University. Dr. Kepner, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So your paper is about an incredibly important issue, as many of them are, in the Archives. And in this case, it's about access to and use of stroke rehabilitation services. And you draw a lot of interesting parallels here and talk about the hypotheses that that you and your group had that led you to do this study and so forth. And we're going to get into that in a minute. First, I wanted to chat for a moment about your work at Cleveland State. And I see that you have a particular interest in healthcare disparities, and you actually mentioned what I thought was interesting in a reply to an email requesting this interview that you were going to be spending some time in prison. can you tell me about that?
I have developed a relationship with our local women's prison. It's a reintegration center, so the women are up to 2 years before release into the community. So we have been working on providing occupational therapy services over at the women's prison, specifically looking at daily living skills. But currently we're running a few different studies, so collecting data about sensory processing, life experience, leisure, and hopefully getting some information out that'll be valuable to other OTs and then other facilities in the area.
Well, this just raises so many questions for me as someone in rehab. I'm not even sure the general public even could process or understand what we're discussing right now, which is the fact that I think most people are aware that people in prison populations may have some degree of mental health disorders, and certainly that applies to homeless populations and so forth and that type of thing. But you're talking about impairment to the level that people can't function in their daily routines and they're in prison.
Right. So we're looking at, I mean, the problem with a lot of the prison population, I mean, there's a lot of people in prison and women in particular who have mental health concerns. And a lot of young people in prison who haven't developed life skills that they need to get out. The recidivism rate is really high. So I think it's up to 80% of individuals who are incarcerated end up back in prison within, I think it's 8 years now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the research suggests that their lack of opportunity and lack of real skills mm-hmm. is what pushes people back into the criminal lifestyle and back into the prison
yeah.
system.
America's prison systems are some of the largest healthcare providers in the United States, which is kind of scary. Actually, a lot of people don't realize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we can either provide that care up front and maybe keep people out of prison, or end up doing it later, perhaps. I don't know if you share that opinion, but that's mine.
Yeah. No. Absolutely.
Well, fascinating work there. And so this work, however, is on the CMS population, the Medicare fee-for-service population, and you're culling through a lot of data here about utilization, including the diagnosis codes and what people are reporting on this survey in order to determine how much they're using rehab services. So let's get to kind of the general idea. You tell us what spawned you and your group to do this particular study. What were you guys thinking?
Well, I was the only therapist in the group, and trying to find a population of individuals who may be underserviced was kind of my primary concern. when you look at the guidelines for stroke care as a therapist, you know that if people come to therapy, you can check for small changes in people, provide services, you know, even caregiver education, different kinds of exercises or adaptations, but that people aren't necessarily coming to therapy because they don't think about it. Mm-hmm. And even as a therapist, thinking about referral patterns, thinking about whether or not physicians are referring people to therapy after they've gone through that initial episode of stroke. Mm-hmm. In the literature, there's a lot about stroke in the early stages. So say up to a year or 2 years, there's definitely not as much that looks long-term at stroke survivors. So that was where I had gotten that idea. Mm-hmm. And I was just lucky enough to be in a situation where we had access to the Medicare claims data. And so the linkage between the Health and Retirement Survey and the Medicare claims data was, I shouldn't say it was an easy feat, but it was lend itself to this study.
Yeah, so that health and retirement study has been going on for a while, a large project. Is that, and that's based, what institution is that based out of?
The Health and Retirement Survey is at University of Michigan.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. You guys hypothesized that potentially quite a lot of variables could end up being related to people utilizing services and then end up narrowing down on a couple. I'll kind of brief our listeners with a list here. The number of comorbidities, the severity of the stroke, the presence of any new stroke. The higher the socioeconomic status, and I would agree that would seem reasonable that people's higher socioeconomic status might be more aware or have people around them who can get them better access to services. Mm-hmm. History of regular physician visits certainly makes sense. Their baseline physical activity, how high that is, the size of their social support networks, and so forth. All those types of things might drive people to use more rehab services after an incident stroke over the course of the following decade. But let's go ahead and cut to the chase, because that's not ultimately entirely what the data proved, at least turned out to be statistically significant. What did you find?
We really just found that age was the primary driver of services, mm-hmm. and another incident stroke.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that somewhat surprising?
Yeah, I was really hoping as an OT to look at those social factors to be more significant, or some of the lifestyle factors. But it makes sense that the age and another stroke would put someone back into the system. You know, as we age, we tend to have more disabling conditions. If you have another stroke, you'd end up back in the system too. So not necessarily surprising, but, you know, hoping that there'd be some other factor that would have come up that would maybe point more towards intervention or something that we could do to help people.
Right. The overall numbers might be lower than listeners might recognize in terms of how, I mean, these are folks who are in the Medicare system, have had a stroke. You would think perhaps the majority might be referred to rehab services. Obviously, many of them might be mild strokes, and presumably that's mm-hmm. what this reflects. But it's around 20% of folks who are accessing rehab services, with most of that being in the first 2 years. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was also surprising, because there was a report from the CDC a number of years ago. I think it was one of the kind of landmark reports about people's utilization of therapy. And they had actually reported up to about 30% of people using therapy services after a stroke. So we didn't find quite as high of a pattern of usage. Mm-hmm. All the guidelines suggest that really people should be seen after they've had a stroke, seen once a year for at least a screening by a OT or PT to detect any functional changes.
Yeah. And you draw the parallel that, and you mentioned that there's other research showing that stroke survivors in the community aren't getting the same level of formal care as individuals mm-hmm. with other neurologic conditions. I think of perhaps Parkinson's disease or MS or so forth. I mean, obviously there are potentially progressive diseases that demand continuous follow-up, but perhaps mm-hmm. there is less of a recognition than there should be that stroke can be progressive as well, or certainly changing, that a stroke is going to certainly result in an immediate functional decline and getting back to a certain level, but things will continue to change and evolve over time that may mm-hmm. necessitate therapist getting involved.
Right, right. Yeah, it makes sense for the neurologic conditions to have some progressive decline, but I do, like you said, I don't think that it's kind of common knowledge to think, hey, I had a stroke and maybe in 2 years, because I have certain kind of unforeseen challenge, that I might become more sedentary, and then that might impact other things, maybe make me less likely to get up out of the house, or make me a little weaker, and maybe I have a few more falls. But then unless we really take a careful look at those things, we're not seeing it. Mm-hmm. That's just my hypothesis.
And, I suppose in terms of, reasons why it couldn't entirely be sussed out, one presumes that there must be some linkage to some of these other kind of social determinants and so forth. But you do talk about the fact that there are certainly some limitations from this genre of research. How would you describe those?
I mean, because we use it was nice to have the health and retirement study, because we got some of those social determinants of health. So social support, we looked at lifestyle factors, we could look at socioeconomic status, work, employment, but it was at 2 year intervals. Mm-hmm. So we really don't know what was happening between. The only way we captured some information was through the Medicare claims data. So we could look at utilization between the waves, but, anytime you look at, you use survey data, it has that limitation. There's some recall bias. There's also that it's not capturing everything that's happening in between.
Did you see any way, I mean, I'm sure that gets very hard with this level of data, but you could determine what people's thoughts were about the efficacy of their rehab interventions, or whether they felt that they were improving those who were using it, maybe perhaps those of a similar apparent through the survey questioning level of magnitude of stroke who maybe weren't getting as much access.
Yeah, I mean, in this survey data, we weren't able to capture that. I believe that the NHATS data has more of those variables, and I don't know that much about it, but I have been curious about looking into that particular data set more, because they've been looking a little bit more heavily at rehab services and I think perceptions of rehab as well as other functional measures. So I think there may be some other surveys that are coming out, or at least have been out, but adding some variables to them that may be able to capture some of those, but we weren't able to do that with our data set.
Okay, very good. Well, it is, to my knowledge, relatively novel type of approach. I mean, looking at the matching up the survey data with what was actually in build for and CMS to really make sure that data was valid. Is that at least certainly for this particular type of question about utilization of stroke rehab services, is there a larger body of research or people doing similar things?
There are some people doing it, but I don't think that it's done enough. I think, mm-hmm. especially now with some of the payment changes right now, I believe that therapists should be getting more involved in this kind of work. I feel like, there's good collaborations that people could have with researchers who are looking at large databases. I just don't think that therapists in general are doing a lot of that work. But I think I see it increasing.
Well, utilizing tools like this, or just kind of in this general area, are you going to kind of pursue these types of questions further with stroke rehab in particular or other conditions?
I hope to be doing some more large database work. I'm working on a few different projects. I'm not sure that I'll focus on stroke mm-hmm. in the near future, but definitely looking at large databases and how we can get a little more word out about what therapy can and cannot do, or looking at utilization, what may be factors that limit or facilitate people's use of therapy is something that's of interest to me.
Great. Excellent. Well, I think this is a good overview of the study for our listeners. And if there's anything else you wish to add, feel free. But otherwise, this looks great.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I think that I was excited about this study. I'm happy to get it out there, because I do believe that we use some pretty unique ways to do the analysis, and the databases, I think, were there for us to use. And mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't necessarily the most earth-shattering results, but definitely a step towards thinking through other studies in the future that could maybe highlight therapy a little bit better.
Definitely. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
All right. Great. Thanks.
And that's it for this November and December edition of the Rehab Cast. I'll see you in 2020. And be sure to put October 21st through 24th on your calendar. It's the 97th annual conference in my hometown of Atlanta.
ACRM will be visiting Atlanta twice in 2020. First up will be the ACRM Training Institute at the Spring Meeting. Held April 23rd to 26th, this economical hands-on series of workshops and community meetings is ideal for networking and increasing your involvement in the world of rehabilitation research and clinical training. Then join us in the fall for ACRM 2020. Coming off a record-breaking year in Chicago, the annual conference is the number one meeting for interdisciplinary rehabilitation research and clinical practice. Go to acrm.org and click on Meetings to get started.